Welcome, friends, to episode 49 of the Nats GM Show, the only podcast available exclusively through the Nats GM Radio Network. I am your host, Ryan Sullivan, editor-in-chief of NatsGM.com and the Baron of all baseball podcasts. Before we start talking baseball, one quick note of business. Our podcast is looking for sponsors. So if you or anyone you know is interested in reaching a few thousand people per episode, please visit NatsGM.com for further details on sponsoring this podcast.
This is Jason Parks from Baseball Prospectus, and you're listening to the Nats GM Show.
And now, without further ado, I am proud to welcome this week's guest, Baseball Prospectus author, the inventor of hashtag gory math, and Letters to Cleo's number one fan, Russell Carlton. Russell, welcome to the show.
Hey, Letters to Cleo now follows me on Twitter, which is like 15-year-old me when I saw that was just squealed with delight. Hi.
That is amazing. Did they really follow you? That's great.
It was actually after the last time I talked to you, I put a little note in on the little Twitter thing I sent out, and I tagged them in it, and I guess they listened, and whoever runs their account added me on Twitter. So, what can I say? I'm living the life.
Well, let's maybe that's a great place to start for anybody that doesn't know the inside joke. Is how did you become Letters to Cleo's number one fan?
I grew up a child of the 90s, and I remember hearing the band on the radio, and, you know, I really liked them and, you know, bought their CDs, and I became their song Pizza Cutter was – I always really liked it. And so when I was in college, I would start off my college radio show with that song, and I would say, you know, hi, I'm the Pizza Cutter. This is the Pizza Cutter Show, and we just started off with the Pizza Cutter song. And that was my thing. And so I my DJ name was Pizza Cutter, and after their song. And so that's how I kind of became the whole Pizza Cutter persona. And then in 2007, when I started writing about baseball online, I needed an alias online to protect my professional privacy at the time. And so I used that, and so that became my Twitter handle, and it started off as just this little thing I did back in 1999 on a college radio show that nobody listened to, and it has followed me now for the last 15 years. So, you know, Kay Hanley, if you are out there listening to this, I love your band, and you have had an extended impression on my life that I don't know if you ever thought would be part of it. So
that legitimately makes my week that Letters to Cleo followed you. I mean, I've got a huge grin on my face. That's so great. I saw them twice in concert as a kid. I was a child of the 90s as well, and watching that young lady dance around on stage was one of the happier moments of my teenage years. So
I understand.
So I'm gonna somehow try to transition from college radio to the grind of the long baseball season, and you wrote a piece.
Hashtag podcasting.
Yeah, right. And terrible segue. So, but I did want to segue and try to talk to you a little bit about your piece you wrote about the grind and the length of the season, particularly with we're late in the season now. Goodness, we're almost at the end, depending on when everybody's listening to this. So I guess the best place to start is just to give you a spot to kind of introduce what you found.
Well, I mean, you think about it, and you know, you think about the human element of the game. You know, these guys have been doing this since March, and you know, think about what, you know, things that you've been doing since March and on a daily basis. And I mean, you know, many of the people out there are going to be, you know, say, "Oh, I have a job," and well, yeah, but your job probably doesn't, you know, require that you essentially live it, and you travel constantly for that job, and you're in different cities every couple of days. You know, it's hot. Baseball's a really taxing game. These guys are working several hours a day beyond the, you know, the 7 to 10 at night that you see them on TV. So it's a long game. And so, you know, you talk to baseball players and you hear them talk about the grind of the long season. And so I started thinking, okay, well, how could we measure that? And so I came up with a way, and it's, you know, you probably won't see it in terms of even something as simple as, you know, batting average. Maybe you see, you know, a little bit over time, you see it's, oh, this is a point lower in September than it is in July, for example. But you could kind of look at that and go, you know, that's just randomness, and that, you know, things happen. And you also have, you know, pitchers and hitters have both been feeling it because they've both been at it since March. So, you know, who really wins in that? So I said, okay, well, let me look at more like strike zone judgment. Let's look at, you know, how many times are we seeing that a pitch ends in a strike? And the nice thing is you get a whole bunch more pitches than you get plate appearances, and you can look at guys over time, and you can kind of control for their overall things. And if you take a look at that and you plot that and you see just a simple question, did this pitch end in a strike? And whether that's because you fouled it off or you swung and missed or it was a called strike versus a ball or a two-strike foul or putting it into play, did the pitch end in a strike? You see that slope of the line kind of tilts downward over time. And downward meaning that there are more strikes. You don't want those strikes. And that's a pretty good proxy for, you know, for how a guy's doing in terms of plate discipline, which is where if you're going to be tired because of the grind is where you're going to see it. Because that's where you really have to concentrate for those, you know, couple minutes when you're in the batter's box.
Sure.
So I looked at it that way. And I found over time that we know that there are hitters and that hitters seem to deteriorate over time. But it seems that there are certain managers that do a better job at kind of arresting that decline than others. And a couple where they could kind of keep it level or even, you know, their players get slightly better. As a manager, you're mostly hoping to just kind of stanch the bleeding, but that was you know kind of one of those things. And I looked and I said, okay, well, what's that worth? And I calculated it out, and it turned out that you know the variance between the best and the worst managers in baseball was something on the order of about 30 runs, and you know that's a that's a lot of value that's kind of being bled away. Just through the, you know, this kind of fatigue element. So that was where that piece went. And I had, you know, I've been doing a couple of things here and there with that concept. So that's been, you know, one of those areas that we don't really think about. You know, how can that fatigue be managed? And if, you know, a team could come up with, here's how we're going to manage it a little better, maybe, you know, they could really turn some good value out of that.
Well, maybe that would be a good – let me throw the question back in your lap, so to speak. How can they, you know, stem – how can a manager – you know, you talked about 30 runs, and that was a terrific piece as well.
Yeah.
How can they stem the tide of – or staunch the, or stop the bleeding, so to speak?
Well, I mean, there's – you know, you think about, you know, how are players rested. But you also think about, you know, recently there was an article that you know, everybody's favorite genius manager, Joe Maddon – has actually, for the most part, gotten rid of batting practice for the Cubs. And part of that is just kind of the way that the Cubs baseball works is that they play a lot of day games because of Wrigley Field, because of ordinances in Chicago saying they can only play about half of their games at night, with half of them being day games. And, you know, I used to live on the north side of Chicago, so I know this all firsthand. And so you think about what that does to the schedule. Okay, well, if it's a 1 o'clock game, that means you're getting to the park at what time, and then you've got to be up and at doing batting practice at, you know, 11 o'clock, and well, you got to be there a little earlier than that. But if you just kind of bang batting practice and say, no, we're not going to do it, well, it gives those guys an extra hour to sleep in. And, you know, you might not think of that, but how many times have you wondered, have you wanted so desperately, just give me one more hour. I know I'd be golden if I had one more hour. And, you know, baseball players have that same thing. You know, they're humans. They like to sleep. And
Well, and they're also not sitting outside in potentially 90-degree heat for an hour and expending whatever that energy is as well.
Mm-hmm, yeah. And then you get into, well, you know, what does batting practice really do? And so, you know, they said, well, maybe just the rest and the, you know, the not going through that work is worth more to us than any benefits that we might get from, you know, hitting lazy fly balls to relief pitchers who are just standing out there kind of talking about the weather, I guess. So
that's fascinating, though. That is a really good idea. If you could get over some of the disappointment of the fans not, you know, getting to watch BP and all that, and I think that's a terrific idea.
Well, I mean, realistically, BP, you're just kind of sitting there autograph hounding, and it's, you know, 10-year-olds who are, you know, yelling for whoever their favorite player is, and you could still go out and do that. That's not, I suppose, too taxing.
Yeah, those 10-year-olds are a lot quicker than I am. I mean, but in all seriousness, are there any other ways that you've seen or you've heard that managers are trying to? I mean, obviously, give them a day off after a night game, or a day game after a night game, in the easy things. But I guess what else can a manager do to be worth 30 runs?
Well, you know, I mean, I don't know that it's even so much. I mean, the manager, maybe it's, you know, kind of the old pep talk of, you know, you might feel like you just want to give up. And the manager might give you a reason to stick around and stay motivated. And maybe your name might be on the lineup card, but you're taking the day off, as it were. And you know, maybe there's something to that, you know, that motivational aspect that sabermetricians, we kind of, you know, poo-poo and, oh, you know, all that soft stuff. We can't quantify that. Why are we messing around with this garbage? But you know, there might be something to that piece that we're quick to dismiss that could have real tangible effects on on a player. I mean, I've defined team chemistry as the answer to the question, why should I care? And you know, it's real easy in baseball to just kind of check out for a little while because there's just so much stuff going on for so long, for 7 months. And, you know, now that we're at the end of the season, I'm sure somebody's feeling that. And especially if they're a team that doesn't have a lot to play for and they've kind of checked out, that would be something that the manager could do or could be really bad at. And, you know, maybe that's something that that's how we would measure on the field effects of that sort of soft skill.
Well, and you almost gave me a perfect segue with your 7 months has gone too so fast. That was a recent column you wrote. I don't know if it was this week, but it was certainly the last couple of weeks here at Baseball Prospectus, and your findings kind of blew me away. What you found in it, and I don't want to actually let me give you the floor to kind of what you found.
Well, I mean, I wanted to ask the question, you know, we've got a lot of September call-ups, you've got, you know, the inevitable guy who's hitting way above what anybody thought, and, you know, looks amazing, and, you know, and there are certain teams that, you know, a guy is just, you know, your team's out of the hunt, and now you got a guy who comes up from AAA, and, you know, they thought he might be a bit of a prospect, but nobody expected him to do this. And not to get all internet clickbait headline on you, but he comes up, and now, but then, you know, the retort is always, well, it's September, you know. Guys are dogging it, and you're facing off against, you know, subpar pitching because everybody else is bringing up their scrubs from AAA just for depth, and you're facing off a guy who's a seventh starter basically every couple nights, and you're facing off against the guy who the team just wanted to get a look at for an inning, and so it's real easy to take September stats and kind of poo-poo them. And, you know, one of the things you have to think about in September is that, you know, if a guy comes up on September 2nd, and even if he plays every day, he's going to get, you know, maybe 100 plate appearances, or if he's a starter, he'll get, you know, 5 starts maybe over the course of the month. And you don't want to go crazy over that from a sample size perspective. But I took a look and I said, okay, well, what about the other things? You know, are, for example, veterans just dogging it? If you're out of the race and it's just not a thing, do we see some guys just kind of drop off on, you know, a systematic level? Do we see that, how many plate appearances are coming against kind of your fringy guys? And I said, okay, so in terms of how many plate appearances are coming against fringy guys, we find out that, you know, as we might expect, the fringy guys, and I think I defined it as guys who have fewer than 250 plate appearances. So these would be some of your, you know, utility infielder guys and who are just playing, you know, more every day because the other guys don't want to play, I guess.
Right, sure.
And the AAA guys and the September call-ups. Those do spike in September at, compared to, you know, August, July, et cetera. But what we find is that while they do spike, the performance that you get out of the group that is there is actually a little better. And you think, you know, we're kind of coming up against a little better quality of fringe guy because a lot of times teams are bringing up their, you know, their top prospects who in a year or two are going to be regulars. And so they already have that talent base there. So, you know, you're facing off guys who are fringe now, but, you know, aren't going to be fringe for very long. They're just kind of need to mature into it. The thing is, I looked at veterans and I said, you know, are they dogging it if they're out of the race? And it turns out that with veterans, guys who have been around, guys who play on a consistent basis, when they play against each other, when they're facing off against each other in a September at bat, you pretty much get the same sort of thing that you would expect if it was a July at bat statistically. There doesn't seem to be a lot of differential there. So it didn't seem like you were getting too much of a difference. So, you know, I came to the conclusion, I said, you know, other than the small sample size piece, you can actually trust September stats fairly well. You're always going to be facing the occasional, you know, depth guy who gets called up in an emergency to fill in for a guy who went on the DL. You know, teams always kind of have to pull that. You know, there's that one night where you have to pull the guy up from AAA because you have no other options and you know it's not going to be a fun night. And he goes 3 1/3 and gives up 7 runs. And, and you know, you just kind of needed the length from him. He goes back to AAA the next day. And you get a little bit more of that in September, but it's not as big a deal as people make it out to be.
Yeah, the timing of this article was great because I've been wrestling with, you know, Matt Dentegger for the Nationals, yeah, who's been on fire most of the month, and Worth has been sitting and so forth, and I've been battling kind of in my head of how much is this hot streak legitimate, and obviously he's playing over his head, but right, how much of it is legitimate and how much of it is, oh, he's just playing against a bunch of guys that are, you know, what's the phrase? You know, they'll be bagging groceries next week or something.
Right,
you know,
yeah.
And it's interesting that the timing came up that, you know, like you say, except for the sample size, which is something you got to keep in yep, mind, that you know, this is pretty legitimate, which I found, you know, kind of promising, if nothing else.
Yeah.
I also think that this could be useful for fantasy players. I'm not much of a fantasy baseball player, but I would think that these, you know, I would certainly think people would look at September stats and maybe people would automatically dismiss them. Maybe that might be a place for some value.
Yeah. I think, though, you know, the nice thing about September is that, you know, for Dendecker or somebody like that, you know, maybe he's trying something new. You know, the pressure's off, unfortunately, for the Nationals. And, you know, maybe he's experimenting a little bit and maybe he will actually learn something. Those extra plate appearances that they talk about, you know, oh, we wanted to get our guys up and we wanted to get them some real live, you know, major league action. You know, there's teams say that and we kind of tend to go, oh, sure, yeah, whatever. But, you know, guys try different things in those situations because you can. And, you know, maybe he picks up on something that works and next year he's like, oh, you know, that worked at the end of last year. Maybe I'll try that again. And if it's functional for him, that's great. He's picked up a new skill and maybe he's a better hitter or, you know, a better whatever he wants to be. And so, you know, there's something to that. September isn't worthless baseball, even if your team's out of it. There's still development going on, and you still hear in front offices, you hear a lot of talk about, okay, well, we want to have this guy work on this thing that he's been working on all year, and now he gets to do it at the major league level.
Well, and like you say, just because your team's out of it, it isn't meaningless baseball. So, but let's talk about some meaningful baseball. I think if it isn't your most recent column, it's one of the most. You talked about Matt Harvey. Obviously, a guy coming off Tommy John surgery, there was a little bit of hubbub or hullabaloo at the beginning of the month. It's after 10 o'clock, and Lord knows what words I'm using at this point. But Long and the short, I want to give you another piece that just really caught my attention and rocked my brain. So fill me in on what you found out about Matt Harvey, Tommy John, and Endings Limits.
Well, some of your listeners, being a national show, might be familiar with a guy by the name of Steven Strasburg.
Yes.
And some of them might remember all the way back to 2012, which, you know,
we do have fans from that far back. We do, I promise you.
Okay. I marked time in how many kids ago that was in my life. But, back in 2012, some of your listeners may remember that there was a little bit of unpleasantness around Strasburg and him coming back from Tommy John, which he had the surgery in 2011. And there was the entire summer of 160 innings. And the Nationals, of course, shut him down in September prior to the playoffs, and he did not pitch in that division series. And who was the fourth guy they threw out there? And I can't remember
Ross
who it
Detweiler.
Was. Oh, it was Ross Detweiler. That's right. And you could think, maybe Strasburg would have made that start, and let's just call it here. The Nationals would have won the World Series that year. That's totally what would have happened. but the thought was, let's protect his health now by limiting his innings this first year back after Tommy John surgery. And that way he will be more healthy in the coming years in, 2013 when they made the playoffs, in 2015 when they make the playoffs. In 2014 they actually made the playoffs, but that they would be preserving his health. That was more important. And of course, the way that this all kind of shook out is that in 2014, he did get one playoff start, and that was what they were apparently saving him for. Moral of the story, kids, is that you never know what tomorrow's going to bring. So, we now fast forward to Matt Harvey, this year, and him coming off Tommy John surgery from last year. And Harvey, there was the talk of, he's only going to throw 180 innings. So I heard all that and I said, okay, well, fine. Let's take a look. Do we have any evidence that that these kinds of innings limits or, people talk about, an inning's kind of a weird thing because you could throw three pitches and get out of an inning. Or you could throw 50 pitches and get out of an inning. And we think of, obviously it's going to be a little different. So I looked at, I was able to get pitch count data and I was able to get batters faced. And do we, is there any evidence that a guy who goes through a significant elbow injury or Tommy John or something like that, and I used elbow injuries that required the 60-day DL, is there any evidence that that actually keeps them healthier? And the answer was no. And I went through and I tried it every which way I could. And I'm like, is there any evidence here? And the answer is just there's no evidence that an innings limit is going to help a Tommy John patient. And, I was looking at that output off my statistical program, and I'm like, wow, that's – okay, this kind of says something here. And so I wrote it up and – the thing to realize about that is the best predictor of a pitcher getting injured is whether he's been injured before. So Matt Harvey has a big risk factor for getting injured next year or this year or 2 years from now, whatever it is, and that's that he's been hurt before. But what I'm finding is that he doesn't get any additional injury risk from pitching any additional innings. So one of the things I said there is, I'm an epidemiologist, not an orthopedist. So, if looking at his chart, people are saying, oh, well, this is, it really, that ligament or is really just hanging on by a thread or something like that, or there's some reason to think that, okay, maybe they had reasons specifically for that. But for the average pitcher, quote unquote, coming back from Tommy John, there's no evidence that, all pitchers coming back from Tommy John should be on an innings limit. There's just no support for that.
So as long as you treat him like a, quote, normal pitcher, you know, you're not having him throw 300 pitches or anything, you know, nonsense, then really his injury risk does not increase from where it already is.
It's already pretty high.
Sure, yeah.
But it just based on the previous injury, but you're not getting any additional risk from pushing him on the innings.
So Harvey in game one.
That would be what I would do, but actually the most recent buzz is Harvey in either game three or four for the Mets, but that's to be seen.
Well, I guess when you can debate whether it's DeGrom or Harvey
DeGrom out there.
Yeah, what a bummer. Yeah, that's a shame. That's a crying shame. It's a crying shame. So one last topic I want to talk to you about a little bit before we get out of here tonight is the recent, probably the biggest topic in baseball right now, happened over the weekend, certainly the biggest in Nats town, so to speak. Bryce Harper, Jonathan Papelbon, and Matt Williams to a much lesser degree.
I haven't heard any of these gentlemen's names.
Right.
Did they do anything of note lately?
Well, one of them could be unemployed in the next 5 days. The other one is going to be heavily on the trade block, and the other one could be the MVP. Just a real quick summation. So,
yeah, I don't think Papelbon's had an MVP kind of year, but anyway. I just so happened that I was sitting down and I opened up Twitter just as after that happened and the Vine was, you know, first out there, and I'm thinking, oh dear God. And of course it's, you know, it's been all over everywhere and that's that kind of happened. And the interesting thing was the kind of backlash to the backlash and the C.J. Nitkowski wrote a piece on Just a Bit Outside, talking, you know, to former players who all kind of said, well, you know, Harper kind of had it coming. You know, we don't condone the choking or anything like that, but he was kind of lollygagging. And then there's been all kinds of Statcast data and all that sort of stuff showing, you know, this is how fast he gets down the line, and he hustles and. It's become this very strange thing, and you know, for something that if that had happened at a bar, Jonathan Papelbon would be in a holding cell right now.
Yes.
You know, I mean, you don't just choke somebody, you know, and you know that's something in baseball or in any other workplace, you know, that somebody would have gotten fired for that. It's kind of a strange thing that we accept that in baseball. So, you know, that's an interesting piece. I've been finding that's been weird over the past couple of days.
And I found it extraordinary that in Nitkowski's piece that he wrote, he said, you know, certain players have reached the point where they are, you know, allowed to dog it, so to speak. And I'm paraphrasing for him. And my first immediate thought was, well, does 41 home runs and leading the league in batting average, is that kind of right in that category? Or I don't understand the – I mean, this is a guy that plays hard every day. I mean, I watch mm-hmm. them. And
yeah.
It just seems strange. And I've seen guys dog a pop-up. Mm-hmm. We've all seen guys really mm-hmm. dog a pop-up. That was not dogging a pop-up.
Right.
I mean, it wasn't hustle either.
No.
But it was not certainly egregious. And that was – that was what I found intriguing to begin the whole thing, was it wasn't the most egregious of examples.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the thing that I keep hearing come back to is that Harper, you know, for the fact that, you know, he's probably going to win the MVP award, and, you know, he's 22, and people keep going, well, you know, and Papelbon's, what, 34 or something along that, something on that level. And you know, the commentary has been largely around, you know, he's still kind of a young little whippersnapper, and he's there seems to be, and maybe C.J. Nitkowski was talking to players who were a little bit older. There seems to be this it lays bare a little bit of a dynamic in the clubhouse of just how wide that age gap is between, you know, the kind of the younger players on your roster and the older players on your roster. you know, I'm 35 years old. I'm a little bit older than Papelbon. I sort of remember 22. Once upon a time, that was several kids ago.
Yeah, I don't remember 22. So,
and you know, that was my and you know, I mean, I look back on myself and I was kind of, you know, I was a different person back then. You know, maybe not better, maybe not worse, but that's something that I keep hearing on that from that age perspective. And realistically, you know, you think a lot happens in, you know, your average lifespan between 22 and where I am now at 35. Let's see. I moved out into my very first apartment. I got married. I moved a couple other times. I got my first real job.
Right.
I bought a house. I had three kids. You know, I mean, that's a lot of big life milestones. And now you've got these guys kind of sitting side by side in the same dugout who are at two very different points in their life. And I think that, you know, some players, and maybe they just take themselves too seriously, and, you know, maybe they take it upon themselves to try and make sure that they're teaching the kids the right way to behave. And kind of a parenting role, I suppose. You know, I keep thinking about – I keep hearing that coming up over and over again and how that plays into it. I think that's kind of what it lays bare, that, you know, Papelbon obviously took out his concerns in the wrong way in terms of, you know, the physical violence. And, you know, everybody's kind of like, oh, well, you know, we get that part. But I think a lot more of the discussion has been around, you know, what is the proper relationship of an older player who is at a very different point in his life as a human being to a younger player.
And I think you nailed it. I think there is a large degree of that age gap does play a part in it. I do think also if it was Jason Worth, who was a hitter who plays every day rather than a reliever who pitches, you know, 70 yeah. innings a year if you're lucky,
innings, yeah.
and has only pitched maybe 10 since he's come over here because the Nats have been such a disaster. Mm-hmm. Maybe that might have gone over a little better as well. I guess the final part I want to kind of ask you about is just your thoughts on Matt Williams in this situation. I don't think he's handled it particularly well, and I think that's kind. Is this a sign that he lost the clubhouse? Is this a sign that... I mean, I think it's kind of a foregone conclusion. He's probably going to lose his job now. If not because of this week, this certainly didn't help.
Well, I mean, I remember seeing a Vine on Twitter, and it was – I forget who – somebody hit a home run, and I think it was Jason Worth. But he came back into the clubhouse, and guys are kind of lining up to do the fist bump, high five sort of thing. And whoever it was – I want to say it was Worth, but don't quote me on that – kind of walked right by Williams, and Williams kind of, you know, tentatively reached out his hand, and he just kind of walked past and went, nah. And that right there, kind of when I saw that happen, I'm like, oh boy, this is not going well. Something is awry in the clubhouse. Because I mean, you think about, I've written about this with, you know, with the high fives and kind of the touch rituals that people have, and you know, and this is something that you know, all cultures, and baseball is a little culture unto itself. They have touch rituals on how people touch each other, and you know, high fives are one thing. You might shake hands with somebody that you just meet in a business setting, but there's kind of a socially prescribed way that you do things. And when you leave somebody on the outside of a touch ritual, and it's, you know, kind of everybody kind of smacks each other's hands when you come back from a home run, and that's what you do, even if you don't even really like each other. Right. But you know, specifically leaving Williams out on something like that, I mean, that right there spoke just mountains worth of words as to what's going on in that clubhouse, and the fact that he was left on the outside there, that's kind of the point where I went, there is gigantic trouble, at least with Williams, and you know, obviously some of that stuff is going to be brewing behind the scenes.
Yeah, I mean, that's just obvious disrespect.
Well, I mean, it's kind of obvious. It's been obvious to just about everybody, and there's, I think, the fact that we got to a point where one player is choking another, and that's just kind of something that happens, is probably a symptom of some larger dysfunction. And, you know, there was talk of, you know, Papelbon was doing this in response to Harper calling him out for hitting Manny Machado about a week ago, and Harper was complaining, oh, you know, you hit Machado, and tomorrow I'm going to get hit because they want to retaliate, and I'm tired of that, and Papelbon didn't take nicely to that. And, you know, Williams's job is basically, before that even happens, to corner both of them and say, look, I know you're both angry at each other, or, you know, I know you might you might be want to yell about this, but dude, keep it in the clubhouse and let's not have this boil over into anything that it doesn't need to be. You know, we all know that baseball has some stuff that we're not, that, you know, isn't very pretty, but, you know, let's just deal with this in the way that we do these things, where we keep it from boiling over into a big issue. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, this is probably symptomatic of a clubhouse that's just not functioning very well as a family, you know. And
and I think
there's probably a lot of parallels in there.
And I think that's, use the word surprising. I think that's the thing that gets you is, I don't want to say we expect it behind closed doors, but you have 30, 35 grown men, testosterone filled, living way too close to each other for 7 months. You know, shouting matches happen. I'm not trying to condone choking by any stretch of the imagination, but I think it's one thing that we think, yeah, that stuff probably happens behind closed doors and we don't know about it. But when we see it up close in the dugout, I think it's almost startling for us.
Yeah, you kind of want to believe, you know, baseball looks so sanitized on television. And I mean, realistically, it's not that, and I don't want to come off and say, oh, well, you know, baseball players are choking each other all the time in the clubhouse. But, you know, guys get into disagreements the same way that, you know, you put any 30 people together and, you know, two of them are not going to like each other. You know, you're probably going to have guys on the team that you're friends with, guys on the team that you just kind of, oh, yeah, I guess I work with him. And there's probably a guy or two that you just don't like. And, you know, part of that, part of a manager's job and part of, you know, the part of the job of the culture that's created within the clubhouse is to manage those conflicts. And, you know, you don't all have to like each other to play well together. And you cannot like each other and just kind of seethe quietly and, you know, no one gets hurt, no one gets choked. And that's okay. And, you know, that's that. And maybe you won't, you know, be godparents to each other's kids, but you know, you can at least get along and deal with each other professionally. And there was some sort of breakdown along that very necessary function in a clubhouse that seems to have led to this. So I mean, that's kind of the stuff that, you know, we may never know all of what happened either, you know, externally or just kind of within people's heads and how it got to this point, but this was a significant breakdown along the way.
Yes. So I guess final question I'll ask you on this subject is just, do you think these two guys can work together in 2016? And I'm talking about Papelbon and Bryce.
Well, I mean, they may have to. I mean, there's a pending, I mean, obviously the Nationals aren't going to get rid of Harper anytime soon. And they may try and trade Papelbon, but yeah, they may get to spring training in March and see each other, you know, standing on the other side of the locker room. You know, I mean, there's whether it's Matt Williams or if it's a new guy, one of the things that they might have to do first off is just sit them down and say, you know, look, you guys might not like each other. You know, maybe you guys can be adults and kind of, you know, talk about this, hash it out and put it behind you and just reach some sort of detente. And I think that, you know, that's something that's whoever takes over that job is going to have to do no matter what. I think they could work together. I think that, you know, in as much as a reliever and a right fielder work together on a consistent basis, but, and I think that they could at least tolerate each other. It may not be pleasant, but, you know, they could at least do it. So, I mean, but it's going to take a little bit of work.
Yeah. And that's a nice, first order of business, so to speak, for whoever I'm assuming is the next manager of this team. So,
yeah.
All right, Russell. Well, I don't want to keep you too much later on a middle of the week during the evening, but I want to thank you first and foremost for coming on the show, and absolutely. I want to give you a spot here to plug where people can find you on Twitter. We've already kind of touched on that a bit, but where they can find you on Twitter, where they can find your work, and everything else in between.
Yeah, follow me on Twitter at PizzaCutter4, because 4 is my favorite number. And let's see, I'm at Baseball Prospectus right there once a week. And then also jabo.com, J-A-B-O, just a bit outside. That's a Fox Sports site that where you'll find Rob Neyer and C.J. Nitkowski and John Paul Morosi and several other cool writers. And I don't know, hanging out around Atlanta if you'll – or in the neighborhood. So,
well, thank you so much for joining me tonight. And I'm a big fan of your work. And I really want to thank you again for joining me tonight and being such a great guest.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. I hope to have you again sometime in the future.
Sounds wonderful.
Sounds good. Thank you. And that was episode 49 with Baseball Prospectus's Russell Carlton. I want to thank him for joining me and being just such a wonderful guest. I always love talking a little baseball with him and getting his insights, particularly from his clinical background and expertise. So thank you to Russell. I also want to thank you for listening and downloading. This is Ryan Sullivan at NatsGM.com on Twitter. Bye for now.